So the other day, I got a text from a friend, not a friend from here, and it was a long text. And it was the kind of text you call back right away. You don't text that one back. And something had happened to a family member of theirs. And I listened as he told the story of everything that happened, or at least everything that he knew that had happened up to that point in time. And it was one of those situations where, like, I didn't know what to say. You know, you so badly want to ask the right questions. You want to say comforting words. But knowing that we won't always have the right words, you don't force words into the silence. You just simply listen. And as I listened, I was drawn into the story. I could feel the tension and the anxiety in my own body as he shared. And I was caught up in the brokenness of the story, and I couldn't help but be bothered. And to be honest, when we hung up, I think I had more questions than when we started. And I really didn't have any hope. I left the conversation with this sense of confusion and despair. And we talked again the next morning after he had learned more of the story, the rest of the story, if you will, the night before. And when he picked up the phone, when I called, I said, I just want to scream. And all I could say was, I know, buddy, but I'm all out of screams. And so I listened as he told the rest of the story, which led from confusion and despair to anger. Angry about what had happened and angry about how it had happened. And yet what I didn't see coming was how in the midst of that anger was a glimmer of hope that didn't exist the night before. And as we come to the second poem in this collection of poems that make up the Book of Lamentations, we see this similar progression of emotion from confusion and despair in the first poem that we saw the last 2 weeks to that of anger, as we're going to see in the second poem this morning, with this ever so faint glimmer of hope. These are poems, as we've talked, that are believed to have been written by the prophet Jeremiah as a witness to the destruction of the city of Jerusalem in 587 BC. Poems that tell the story of Jerusalem not as a place, but as a person, personifying this once great city. Poems that tell the story of her sin and the suffering brought about by her sin. Poems that were performed by the Jewish people each year, generation after generation, as they lamented the destruction and were reminded of their suffering, guiding them through their grief, making these poems a liturgy of lament, a work of the people, something that is lived out together in community with others, pointing us to God and showing us how to lament and why to lament, a liturgy that is guiding us through this season of Lent, this season of reflection as we reflect on our own sin and the brokenness of the world and repenting of our sin and our lack of concern for the suffering of others. And as you heard this morning, as Alvin and Jenny read, we have the same two speakers in the second poem that we had in the first. We have the poet, the narrator that Alvin read, and we have Jerusalem, the personification of this once great city that Jenny read. One speaking about Jerusalem, the other speaking as Jerusalem. And in the first poem, we heard Jerusalem cry out for a comforter, someone to look. And in the second poem, the poet responds, speaking to Jerusalem for the first time, saying, I see. And having opened his eyes, looking and seeing her suffering, having opened his ears, listening, having heard her cries, he has been bothered by her brokenness, angered by her suffering, and he responds by entering her suffering, coming alongside her and comforting the suffering, showing us how to respond to the suffering of others. And so again, the second poem, it begins much like the first did. It begins with the poet describing her suffering, describing what he sees. However, his perspective has changed since the first poem. Listen to what he says in verse 1. He writes, "How the Lord in his anger has set the daughter of Zion under a cloud. He has cast down from heaven to earth the splendor of Israel. He has not remembered his footstool in the day of his anger." Did you pick up on the change? It wasn't what was done. It wasn't who it was done to. No, what changed was who did this to her. He's not describing what King Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian army did to her. He's describing what God did to her. What God did in response to her sin, her repeated rebellion against him over the course of centuries. God setting her under a cloud, covering her with a cloud of his anger. Much like when the sun goes behind a cloud, or in February and January when it goes behind a cloud for like 2 months at a time. It restricts that warmth and light from getting in. We can't see it, and after a few weeks, we wonder if it's even still there. And that's what sin is and what sin does. Right, sin creates this barrier between us and God, separating us, yeah, hiding him in some sense from our view, so to speak, causing him to feel more distant and sound more silent. But this separation that the poet's referring to, it was of a near infinite distance, as far as the heavens are from the earth. As God did something the people of Israel thought unthinkable, he removed his very presence from among his people, having forgotten his footstool. The footstool is one of those complicated words that actually is exactly like what it sounds like. It is a stool you put your feet upon. It's a stool that a king would rest his feet up as he sat on the throne, kind of like when you sit on the couch and put your feet up on the ottoman to watch a movie, or when you kick back and flip up the footrest as you lean back in the Lazy Boy to watch a game. It's this indication that, like, I ain't going anywhere anytime soon. Not till the closing credits, not till the end of the fourth quarter or overtime, if God blesses us with that. God's footstool was his temple, his dwelling place among his people, providing this link between heaven and earth, between God and his people. And the thing is, God got up and left. He left long before the closing credits. He left long before the fourth quarter was over, forgetting his footstool. Not accidentally, but intentionally, severing this link. And the people of Israel, they assumed that God, they assumed he would never leave, right? They were living with this sense of privilege as though they were untouchable. They were protected from their enemies by God. They were a made man in mafia speak. I mean, we're God's chosen people after all, right? He rescued us from Egypt. He gave us the promised land. Forget about it, they said. Felt a sense of privilege. They also felt a sense of entitlement, as though they had been granted some form of immunity, protected from God's judgment. And I can't help but think that we live with that same sense of privilege from time to time, thinking we're untouchable. I mean, I go to church every week. I'm not just Christian, I'm evangelical. I'm the right kind of Christian. We live with that privilege. We live with that sense of entitlement, thinking that we are granted immunity from God's judgment, regardless of what you do. And as a result, we at times justify our sin, calling it an unfortunate means to a necessary end. We excuse our sin. It's not that bad. It's not as bad as theirs. We accommodate our sin. There's nothing I can do about it. We even embrace our sin, sometimes publicly, claiming this is who I am, finding our identity in our sin, and other times secretly hiding what we've done and feeling the shame, even thinking we've hidden it from God. And we not only do this individually, we do this collectively, living with a sense of privilege as a country, thinking that we are somehow, as a nation, set apart by God, protected by God from our enemies. And the same sense of entitlement as the church, the Big C church, thinking that we've been granted immunity from the pain that we've inflicted on others on our own, pushing people away from Jesus rather than pointing them to Jesus. And that's what makes this season of Lent that we are in, this annual time of focused reflection and repentance on sin, so vital to our own spiritual growth and formation, both individually and collectively. And that's what makes this poem of lament so valuable. Because we see that sometimes God does what we might think is unthinkable. His ways are higher than our ways. His thoughts are higher than our thoughts. And we realize we're not untouchable, are we? We've not been granted immunity. The poet, he goes on to describe what God did to them. He describes what he did, destroying them as a nation, acting without mercy, he writes, destroying their fortified cities, bringing an end to the kingdom, cutting off every horn of Israel, the horn of an animal believed to be its source of strength, now severed, withdrawing his right hand, which was typically extended to protect his people and defeat their enemies. His anger burning like a flaming fire, consuming everything. And he directed his anger at her. He directed it and aimed it like an archer, pulling back his bow, his right hand now set against her, having become like an enemy to his own people, multiplying exponentially their mourning and their lamenting. He describes what he did to them as a nation. He describes what they did, what he did to the temple, destroying his temple, this meeting place where God met with his people, laying it to waste, treating this massive structure, right, framed by these giant cedars of Lebanon. Think of something framed with giant sequoias. And he treated it as though it was this flimsy little booth made of twigs in a garden. It was like a tent caught up in a tornado. And the meeting place where the people came to celebrate the festivals and worship on the Sabbath, it was no more. God having abandoned his altar, disowning his sanctuary, and instead of hearing the sound of people praying and instruments playing and worship, all that they could hear was the sound of the enemy celebrating their victory. He describes what God did to the city's defenses. He was methodical. He planned this out, right? Stretching out his measuring line. It's like a carpenter, measure twice, cut once. Only instead of building something great, God was determined to lay the city's walls to ruin. This was no knee-jerk reaction. And he describes what God did to the city's leaders, her kings and priests and princes. The kings and princes, the civil leaders, they were taken away into exile. The law detailing the way that they were to live as God's people in relation to God, in relation to each other, in relation to all of creation, it was no more. The prophets, they received no more visions than the elders. They were left traumatized and speechless as they began their ritual mourning. And like, you can sense the tension building through this. You can feel the prophet's anger in his words, his description of suffering, far more vivid and far more violent than it was in the first poem. But what's interesting is that even though he knows her suffering in this instance was the result of her own sin, his anger isn't directed at her. No, his anger's directed at God. And even though he knows God is entirely justified for what he has done, that's what happens when we take the time to open our eyes and look and see the suffering that's all around us. When we take the time to open our ears and listen and hear the stories of those who are suffering. And that's true regardless of why they're suffering, whether it's a result of something they did, suffering the consequences of their own sin, as was the case with Jerusalem, whether it's the result of something done to them, the consequences of the sin of others committed against them, or the mere presence of sin. Living in a broken world, sin being this poison that has infected every aspect of creation. He can't help but be bothered by the brokenness. He's angered by the suffering. And so he goes on, bothered by her suffering. And for the first time, he opens up And he begins to share what he's feeling, expressing his anger, expressing his sorrow the way Jerusalem did in the first poem. He says, my eyes, they're spent with weeping. He is out of tears. My stomach churns, that anxious feeling you get. He's becoming physically ill to the point that he vomits. And it's all because of the destruction of the daughter of my people. He's no longer a distant observer. This has become personal for him. And what broke him, what brought him to his knees, what brought him to tears was the same thing that caused him to speak up last week in verse 17. It was seeing the suffering of innocent children lying in the streets, he says in verse 12. Hearing the cries of helpless mothers holding their starving babies, asking, where is the bread and the wine? Where are these supplies that were to have been stored up, that were to have lasted a long time? They were gone. The cupboard was bare. The pantry was empty. There was absolutely nothing left in the city. And having now truly seen her, doing the one thing that both the poet and Jerusalem felt that God refused to do, he enters into her suffering, speaking to her for the first time, not to criticize her, not to condemn her, but to comfort her. But the thing is, as he begins to speak, he realizes he doesn't know what to say. He asks, what can I say to comfort you? He doesn't know what to do. He says, what can I do that I may comfort you? He doesn't know who to call for help. He says, who can heal you? He just wants to make it all go away. He just wants to fix it. He wants her suffering to end. And I think we've all felt that sense of helplessness, haven't we? Overwhelmed by the enormity of it all. Not knowing what to say, not knowing what to do. Faced with something beyond anything you've ever experienced. And sometimes we respond in a way where we're bothered-ish by the brokenness, just not enough to do or say anything, hoping someone else will take care of it, hoping it'll just go away if we wait long enough. Other times, though, we go to the other side of the spectrum, don't we? And we fill the silence with noise when we don't know what to say. What we're doing is we are searching for the silver lining, and we are offering our pithy platitudes, words that often do more harm than help. We fill the silence with noise, and we fill the space with commotion when we don't know what to do, doing things that, unbeknownst to us, only add to the suffering and the burden of the one that we should be comforting. We do this most often by just simply asking a barrage of questions when they're too exhausted to answer, forcing them to make decisions when they have nothing left to make a decision with. And we end up no better than Job's friends. We weren't trying to help. But we, you know what we do? We try psychoanalyzing each other as though we've got a bunch of letters after our name, like a therapist or psychiatrist, when we don't. We're trying to diagnose each other, and the reason we're trying to do that is because we just want to fix each other. We want to fix each other so we can avoid entering into their suffering, because you know what? Other people's suffering's messy. It is uncomfortable, and you know what? It rarely fits into your schedule. It's inconvenient. And man, if we can just fix it, it all goes away. Here's the thing. Your refusal and inability to enter into the suffering of others, it may be a reflection of your refusal and inability to enter into your own suffering. You may be projecting your insecurities onto their situation. Henry Nouw, in his book, Turning My Mourning into Dancing, he writes, "We resist getting near the suffering of another partly out of our own unwillingness to suffer ourselves." And he goes on to explain how we misunderstand what compassion truly is. Compassion, he says, means literally to suffer with. To show compassion means sharing in the suffering passion of another. Compassion, understood this way, asks far more of us than a mere stirring of pity or a sympathetic word. More than just thoughts and prayers. More than good vibes and positive thoughts. And that feels overwhelming. And you're like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. Well, let's start with that. It's okay to say, I don't know what to say and I don't know what to do. Amen? That's okay. It is okay to acknowledge your inability to fix every situation ever brought to your attention. That ain't why they're bringing it to you anyway. Because those who suffer, you know what they really want? Oftentimes, they want the same thing Jerusalem wanted. They just want someone to simply see them, to see what they're going through, and to be present with them, to listen to them when they want to talk, and to sit with them in the silence when they don't. What they want is your presence, and they want it when they want it, not necessarily only when you want to give it. They don't just need our presence on the day of the event. A death, an event, whatever it is, not just on the day of, not just on the week of, but the month of, the year of, the decade of, every moment of every day, that pain will never leave them. And one of the things I've learned from those of you who have lost a loved one, especially those of you who have lost a spouse, is how difficult the firsts can be. And I think we're in tune and we're aware of the first year of firsts. The first birthday, yours and theirs, the first anniversary, the first Christmas. But it's not just the first year of firsts, it's all the firsts. And the thing is you don't know when they're gonna sneak up on you. A year later, 5 years later, 10 years later, you go back to that restaurant. You go back to that place you visited on your honeymoon. You watch a movie that you remember together, a song on the radio. You don't know when it's going to hit. And they're as much in need of our comfort then as they are the day of and the week of. See, our response to lament should simply be to join the suffering in their lament. And that's why one little step we are trying to take to form this in ourselves is the liturgy that our formation groups use as part of the way, our spiritual formation groups. And we begin with each person sharing what's on their heart. And then what the group does is they hold what that person has shared in silence for a minute. They physically hold out their hands and they hold it in silence for a minute. And then each person prays for them. And then we go on to the next person. And you notice what our liturgy does not include? It does not include you interjecting your unsolicited two cents trying to fix it. They can invite it, but you don't interject it. And so what do you say? Just start with saying, I'm here for you. And what do you do? Let's just start with being for them, being there for them when they need you. Another thing I came across this week, though, this is a great thing. It's not my idea. I found it on Twitter. Twitter every once in a while gives you good things. It's called grief groceries. And I probably don't even need to explain it, but I'm going to anyway. I don't think you can go all that wrong by doing a quick grocery shopping trip for someone who's suffering, who's grieving, who's mourning. But here's the thing. Don't ask them what they need. Don't call them. Don't text them. Don't force them to make another decision. That's not helpful. So just do this. Get four things. Get the staples. Not physical staples. Get the staples. Get simple meals that do not require 5 hours to make. We can eat things out of the freezer and out of the microwave when we're suffering. Get them snacks, and like the kind of snacks you don't even buy for yourself because they're so good. and get something special for the kids if they have some. Staples, simple meals, snacks, and something special for the kids. And then do this. Either have it delivered or drop it off their front door and ding-dong ditch them. Don't impose yourself on them. Unless they invite you in, don't impose yourself on them. Just send them a text. Hey, I left some groceries on the front door. Some of them need to go in the refrigerator, some in the freezer. I love you. I'm here for you. The poet did not do grocery delivery. They didn't have that yet. The cupboards were bare. We talked about that, but he does enter into her suffering. Sharing in the suffering passion of another, as Henry writes, because her suffering had become his suffering. Her anger had become his anger. And so he's angry now. He's angry at the prophets who failed her, lying to her with false and deceptive visions, lies that misled her, failing to call her out for her sin. He's angry at the people who mocked her, asking, is this the city that was once called the perfection of beauty, the joy of the earth? We said that yesterday when we beat the 4th seed. We were the 12th seed. Is this the 4th seed of the tournament that we handily beat by a point? He's angry at the enemy who defeated her, bragging about what they had done as though they had done it, when in fact God did this. God, having done what he purposed, carrying out his word, which he commanded long ago, doing the very thing he warned them of before they entered the promised land of Canaan, of what he would do if they failed to live according to the way he created and called them to live as his people. If we flip back to Deuteronomy 28, you know what we see? We see God say that they would be defeated. Check. The cities having been besieged. Check. 30-month siege. Children given to another people. Check. The people scattered from one end of the earth to the other. Check. He even specifies that a yoke of iron will be placed on the neck until they're destroyed. The very thing we saw Jerusalem cry out about last week. Check. They were not untouchable. They were not granted immunity. Instead, they were held accountable and judged for their sin. Soong-Cha Ra, in his book, Prophetic Lament, it's not a commentary, but it is a book about lamentation. Subtitle, A Call for Justice in Troubled Times. He writes, if God stays true to his character, and does he do that? Yeah. If God stays true to his character, he has to judge unrighteousness, doesn't he? He has to judge injustice because he takes sin seriously, way more seriously than we do. And not just the sin of all of them, but the sin of us, our sin. This is as true of the unrighteousness committed and justice inflicted by God's own people as it is of others. And it's as true for us as the church, his new covenant people, as it was for Israel, his old covenant people. We will be held accountable for the unrighteousness we've committed and injustice we've inflicted, either by our action or by our inaction. The church is not untouchable. We have not been granted immunity from God's judgment. And like that might make you angry. I hope at some point you've gotten angry this morning. And yet even in the midst of our anger, even our anger at God, we find this glimmer of hope. And like, we gotta look hard for it. We gotta look hard for that light at the end of that swamp. But it's there. Because we're reminded that God is faithful to his word. That he is sovereign over this world. That he is faithful to fulfill every promise he has ever made. Even the promises that we don't necessarily like. And this leads the poet to advocate for her suffering. He becomes her advocate, giving her permission to express her grief. And he calls out to the decimated city walls. He says, let your tears flow like a river. Don't stop. Give yourself no relief. Give your eyes no rest, letting her know there is no need to appear strong for anyone. And that might be the most encouraging piece in this entire poem, especially if you're here and you're suffering and you're grieving and you're mourning. Something that I've begun sharing with those that gather to mourn the loss of a loved one at a funeral is that you have permission to feel whatever you are feeling. And like, you know how sometimes you're laughing hysterically one moment as someone shares a story, and then instantly you're crying uncontrollably? Sometimes you're doing both at the same time. You can't even tell what's going on. That's okay. That's okay. It's okay to feel what you're feeling. Now, we can have a whole other discussion about responding to how we're feeling. We can do that in a not so great way. That's not what we're talking about today. It's okay to feel what you're feeling. You don't need to apologize for laughing. And there's been a couple times where, like, I felt like we've been in the middle of a really serious moment here. And I don't just mean today. And I said something that I didn't mean to be funny, and one of you just couldn't help yourself. You just burst out laughing. It's okay. It's okay when you laugh at a story at a funeral as you remember. You don't need to apologize for laughing, but you also don't need to hold back the tears. You don't need to appear strong for anyone. Guys, eyes up here real quick. It's okay to let those tears flow. You ain't got to appear strong. It's also okay to be angry. And it's even okay to be angry at God. And so the poet encourages her to cry out to God again. He says, cry out in the night. Throughout the night, he says, let him hear you. Pour out your heart like water, like a waterfall. Let him see you. Lift up your hands for the lives of your children that are starving in the streets. And that's exactly what she does. Having been comforted by him, he, having seen her suffering and heard her cries, bothered by her brokenness, entering into her suffering and advocating for her, she lifts her weary head one more time. She cries out one more time, the fourth time now, crying out for God to do exactly the same thing, to simply look and to see. And she goes on to express her anger, asking, do you know, God, who you've done this to? Have you treated anyone else like this? Because the answer was no. Should women be driven to the brink of starvation and left with no other choice but to eat the fruit of their womb, their own children? No. Should your own priests and prophets be killed in the sanctuary by you? No. How is this fair, God? Everyone is dead. The young and the old, men and the women, you killed them all in the day of your anger. You slaughtered your own people and you did it without pity. Now, she ain't holding anything back at this point, is she? Now, she is angry. She is letting God have it. And she ends saying, you did this. No one escaped. No one survived, not even my own children, those I held in my arm and raised. The enemies destroyed them all. And at that point, just like my friend on the phone this week, she was all out of screams. That's the end of the poem. It's the end of chapter 2. Game, set, match. It's no overtime. It's not a Marvel movie with another scene at the end of the credits. Once again, God says nothing and he does nothing. At least it seems. There is a lot of scenes, not just scenes after the closing movie. There's a whole series of movies that come after this one. And they're really good. But what if that's the lesson that we're to take away from this poem in our liturgy of lament? To sit in it. Kathleen O'Connor, in her commentary, writes, laments are prayers of the discontented, the disturbed, and the distraught, those who have been bothered by the brokenness. She says, but remarkably, in the process of harsh complaint, and can we agree that was some pretty harsh complaint she had for God? In the process of harsh complaint and resistance, they also express faith in God in the midst of chaos and doubt and confusion. In the midst of our anger, there is this tiny little glimmer of hope. Lament allows us to be angry at God, even when he's in the right and even when we are in the wrong. Because it gives us this glimmer of hope, knowing that God is just, knowing that God is sovereign, and knowing that God is faithful. Because in the end, guess what? God wins and suffering ends. Amen? That's how Revelation ends. That's how the story ends. With a new heaven and a new earth and resurrection and renewal. None of that stuff exists anymore. There is no Kleenex in heaven because there's no tears. And God willing, no allergies. That's one of those moments where it's okay to laugh. And we are called to live in light of the certainty of that end in the midst of our suffering. And that's what makes eschatology so very important. We are always living in light of the end that we believe. If you fear the end, you will live in fear. If your hope is in the end, you will live in hope every day until then. We don't have to live in fear of getting snatched away and or being left behind. We live with a hope of resurrection. Amen? And so in the meantime, we need to allow lament to run its course. Man, that's uncomfortable. There's no fast forward button. There's no skip ahead button. This isn't a DVD we're watching. And so what we learn from Jerusalem, what that means for us, is that we need to allow others to come alongside and enter into our suffering and comforting us as we suffer, weeping with you as you weep, bearing that burden with you, which, can we be honest, that's scary. It's scary letting others in because we've all been burned by being vulnerable, causing our walls to go up, our defenses to kick in, preventing the very comfort that we desire. That's what we learn from Jerusalem and what we learn from the poet. What this also means is that we need to come alongside and enter into the suffering of others, comforting them as they cry out, having seen their suffering and heard their stories, which requires us to open our eyes to look and open our ears to listen, allowing ourselves to be bothered by their brokenness, regardless of why it is that they suffer, advocating on their behalf as they suffer and doing justice and loving kindness as we walk humbly with the Lord, who, as we know, walks faithfully with us and is with us in our suffering.